Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and our guest this week, the publisher Shane Joseph, and some of the contributors to the third anthology put out by the Spirit of the Hills writers called Hill Spirits 3. The launch of the Hill Spirits 3 is part of a series we are broadcasting in the weeks preceding the Spirit of the Hills Festival of the Arts on November the 3rd and 4th at St. Peter's Anglican Church right here in Coburg. The anthology is a celebration of Canada's 150th by writers from our region and includes a wide variety of styles from short stories to nonfiction, essays, memoir, and poetry. Truly something for everyone. You'll be able to hear some excerpts in a few minutes, but first let's chat with the publisher, Shane Joseph of Blue Denim Press. Welcome, Shane.
Thank you for having me again.
So this anthology, Hill Spirits 3, is obviously the third in a series. So tell us about that series.
Okay, well, we started in 2012 with what we thought was going to be one book. And so we called it Hill Spirits. And we had 21 contributors. It sold a lot of copies. And then we thought we would repeat that experience in 2015 when we launched Hill Spirits 2. And then we had 24 contributors, so the numbers were starting to grow. And this time, Hill Spirits 3, coming out in 2017, has 37 contributors. And there are 48 pieces plus 11 pictures. So they come from a wide variety of writers, nonfiction, fiction, memoir, poetry, and history of the area. So we're excited about this because this is obviously, you know, a growing series. And mm-hmm. I hope it will continue into the future.
Yes, well, I think a little bird told me, too, that pre-sales on it are already over 100. So that's promising.
It's very good.
Yeah. Now, it's Hill Spirits, and the hills referred to in the title are the Northumberland Hills. Northumberland Hills seems an unlikely place to be finding a great group of writers. How did you, as a publisher, find Northumberland as a base for writers?
Well, it was a bit of a mecca, I have to say, because when I arrived here, you know, I never thought I was going to find so many writers and publishers in the area. I think Northumberland, given its proximity to Toronto, is attracting a lot of artists who are moving out of the city and setting up home in a place that's still close to the city, but is away from the madding crowd, as they say, where they could actually focus on their art. So Northumberland has become quite a catchment for artists. Even on the publishing side, when I first came here, there was one publisher that I knew of who did fiction and poetry. And now, in our group alone, we have three. So, you know, it is an interesting place to be in at this time. It is also, you know, through these festivals and artistic endeavors, we are catering to the burgeoning of literature in Canada. I mean, I know that CanLit is still the official medium of distribution, but if you remember, CanLit was invented or created back in the late 60s when Canada had a population of 20 million people. Now we are approaching 40 million, and these government-funded programs are limited in what they can do to and how much they can absorb. So there has to be alternative forms of expression and alternative mm-hmm. forms of distribution. And so what the Spirit of the Hills organization is doing is feeding that alternative channel and making sure that artists who cannot all be included through the CanLit channel are catered for. I mean, it doesn't mean that the quality is any different. I would say in certain cases the quality is even better. But these artists' voices have to be heard. And so I think what Spirit of the Hills is doing something very noble. And we ourselves as small publishers are also trying to do the same thing, to give voice to artists and writers who would normally be consigned to some slush pile and been forgotten. Mm-hmm. So we're very pleased with that. And I hope that at some point in time, the official keepers of the keys, if you will, look upon these alternative groups and say that, you know, they are also making a meaningful contribution to Canadian literature.
Yeah, they are indeed. Can you tell us a little bit more about the launch itself?
Yes, I'm very, very pleased that the launch is being included as part of a much larger event, because I think sometimes trying to launch these events on their own takes a lot of effort, and we tend to clash with other literary events taking place at the same time. So having this as part of a much larger event is a very good idea. It also gives value to the attendees, because they're going to see a lot more things than just a book launch. But at the launch, we're going to have readers, of course, from the anthology. There's going to be music. Some of the readers may actually sing or play. I won't tell you whom. You know, and some of the stories have to do with music. So there will be the reading that lends itself into music. There will be a free book with the entrance ticket to the evening. So that's included. And many of the authors will be there for signing, and you get a chance to meet the authors and chat to them. So I think it's going to be a very interesting evening, and I'm certainly looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much for telling us all about that, Shane. I've been talking with Shane Joseph of Blue Dead and Press, who is the publisher of Hill Spirits 3. And now, listeners, if you'd like to sit back, we are going to give you a taste of what is in the anthology with some readings. So our first reader from the anthology is Renee Smith. So Renee, tell us, what is your contribution to the anthology?
Hi, I'm contributing two stories. I'm actually working on a collection of short stories for adults, which is different for me. My previous books, four books, have been on Canadian disasters, and another novel as a young adult novel. So I'm kind of going back to my old love, which was writing for adults and writing humorous stuff. So that's I'm going to read just a part of one of my stories. It's called Hold That Wire. There's a subtitle. It could also be called Mechanical Aptitude. This is just a story for my youth. Just hold that wire, insisted my oldest brother, Eric. Nothing will happen, I promise. He and my other brother, Werner, were working on an old engine our dad had brought home. He wanted them to learn something useful called mechanical aptitude. Why should I hold it? We need you to hold it so the engine will start. Are you going to shock me? I asked. Their faces were creased with sincerity, masks of good intent. Honest, we would never do that, would we, Werner? Never. Just hold the wire so we can get this thing to work. But I'll get shocked. Not if you hold the end of the wire tightly. Really? It just can't happen. Not at all, agreed Werner. Oh, all right. I held the wire for them while Werner knelt and braced the big engine between his legs, staining his tan corduroy pants with engine grease. Eric balanced himself and kicked down on the big kickstart lever with a mighty tromp. A huge blast of electricity jolted through me. I leapt back and hit the wall. Eric and Werner burst out laughing. You idiot, Eric shouted. Don't you know better than to hold a spark plug wire? My aptitude for mechanical things was always worse when my brothers were around. Like when my brother Werner pointed out that my bicycle wheels didn't spin very easily. We had our bicycles upside down doing the maintenance my dad said was something useful to know. Spin it and see, he said. I spun the front wheel, and after a few turns it stopped. Now spin mine. I did, and it spun like a top, on and on and on. You have to loosen the bearings in the wheel hub. He pointed to the slim little nuts in there and left me to it. Why is your wheel wobbling like that? Eric asked a few days later. I was loaded with 30 copies of the Saturday Toronto Star for my paper route. The front wheel had been turning freely ever since the adjustment, maybe too freely. Werner showed me how to loosen it. And you believed him? Eric demanded. You've got to tighten those, he said, pointing to those same nasty thin nuts that I'd spent an hour on. They were getting more rounded every time I wrenched them with my old adjustable wrench, the only tool I owned. I unloaded the bike, flipped it over, made the adjustment in the growing darkness, and took off to deliver papers. By the time I got home, there was a suspicious grinding sound coming from the wheel hub. You listen to Eric? No wonder you screwed it up, observed Werner. Better do the back wheel now. Even them up. By the end of the week, my bicycle's ball bearings were reduced to some bits of steely gravel, and the bearing cups were full of cracks and unusable. Dad was really pissed about me needing two new bicycle wheels. For Christmas, Dad bought us a Meccano set with all the little steel brackets and flanges and nuts and bolts, telling us with some pride how he had made Meccano displays of windmills and such like for the toy shop when he grew up in the old country. Let's see what you can make, boys, he said. My brothers made simple little racing cars with moving wheels. He was disappointed that they didn't steer or have a differential. I made a little gallows with a Meccano man hanging from it by its neck. It had no moving parts whatsoever. Dad shook his head in disgust and said something in Dutch about my mechanical aptitude. That's as far as I'll read for now.
But Werner does get his own back by the end of the story.
By the end of the story, yes. Yeah, it's kind of a fun story.
Well, thank you, Rene.
You're welcome.
So our next reader is Alan Bland, who also writes funny stories. And I'll leave it to you, Alan, to introduce yours.
Okay, this is a little bit of a story that has some truth to it, I think. And it's set up in North Trent Hills in the 1950s. It's called Old Jubal and Homer. Northumberland County is mostly peaceful these days, notwithstanding that there is a federal penitentiary up in Warkworth. But it wasn't always that way. Back around 1950, there were some shenanigans up in what is now Trent Hills, where some of the old farm families descended from the original settlers still lived according to their own rules. If you had asked anyone around town, none of them would have remembered exactly how it had started. Some said it was when old Jubal's hogs got out and rooted up all the vegetables in Homer's wife's garden. But others would say that the hogs wouldn't have got out if that old rotted-out oak tree of Homer's hadn't come down in the storm and busted the fence between his wife's veggie patch and old Jubal's hog run. It didn't help things along when Homer decided that the only way to placate his wife and to stop the hogs gorging on her prized veggies was to shoot those darn hogs. And that's what he did, all three of them. Now, old Jubal had been in town picking up supplies, some of which he would no longer need, as his hogs had permanently lost their appetites. When old Jubal arrived back from town, his rusty pickup clanking and wheezing up the rutted lane and splashing through the puddles left by the storm, he could sense something was wrong. Homer's boys, Wilbur and Walter, had hefted the hogs back onto old Jubal's side of the property line, but there was no hiding those bullet holes, right between the eyes on each of those three hogs. But first he went to visit Homer and let it be known that an explanation was expected as to how he had three murdered hogs in his yard and why Homer was sitting on his front porch with that big Winchester rifle over his knee and his two strapping sons, Wilbur and Walter, sitting one on each side of him. Well, as you can imagine, that meeting didn't go too well. What with old Jubal wanting payment for his three hogs and Homer telling him to just get them out to the abattoir before they went off and were only fit for the landfill. Old Jubal pointing out that the abattoir couldn't take them as they were already dead. And Homer pointing out that he knew that old Jubal had butchered a few hogs in his barn every year. So why not now? A kind of compromise was worked out that at least dealt with the dead hogs. Wilbur and Walter helped old Jubal get those hogs into the barn where they were hung and dressed. Homer bought all the meat from one and filled his freezer, while old Jubal took care of the other two. And then some more money changed hands from Homer to old Jubal. Walter and Wilbur got out the chainsaws and cleaned up the oak tree that had fallen on the fence and started the whole shebang in the first place. And that should have been the end of it. Except old Jubal still felt he had been wronged by Homer, and so he phoned his cousins, Clancy and Yancey, who were well known as animal trappers. Homer and his wife and their boys, Wilbur and Walter, had been to town to buy feed for the chickens that Homer's wife raised. As Homer drove his old rusted pickup down his lane and over the ruts, he felt that something was amiss. There were chickens flapping around in the yard, a pair of foxes, blood and feathers on their mouths, run for the hole in the fence that was still to be fixed, out of the yard and into the fields. Once Homer and his wife entered the chicken run, they could see the extent of the havoc that the foxes had wrought. Not a single chicken was left alive. The few that had escaped into the yard looked like they were all maimed and bloody. Homer looked across the yard to his neighbor's property, where old Jubal and his cousins, Clancy and Yancey, sat on the porch with shotguns over their knees. So it didn't look like it was over yet, but that's how it had started. So that's my
thanks,
little story.
Well, thank you very, very much. And now we'll take a short break.